Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This November 3rd, 2015 edition, episode 62 of Nature Bats Last comes live to you from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico and from somewhere else close by. I'm Mike Sleeve along with the good doctor, Guy McPherson, and our thanks to Afrizen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Today's show we have rewilding expert Jeriah Bowser and a discussion with Guy after his appearance on National Geographic Explorer with Bill Nye, the science guy. It's also a call-in show, and we'll be taking your call, so please dial us up toll-free at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And we'll begin with our guest interview. Jeriah is an autodidactic generalist, which is a fancy way of saying that he is a self-motivated scholar of many disciplines. Having been introduced to religious fundamentalism, abuse, incarceration, and suffering at an early age, he has since dedicated his life to search for meaning, truth, and beauty in this strange and sick world of ours. This pursuit has led him to some rather odd conclusions and beliefs, which he writes about in various books and essays he has authored, as well as chairing the Hampton Institute's Ecology and Sustainability Department. Jeriah has also spent the past decade exploring these questions in his career as a wilderness therapy guide and outdoor educator. Facilitating rewilding experiences for other humans has proven to be deeply meaningful and healing for his own journey. While he shies away from labels, Jeriah is strongly influenced by anti-civilization anarchism, primitivism, deep ecology, Neo-Luddism, animal and earth liberation, anti-modernism, eco-psychology, Jungian depth psychology, radical therapy, anti-psychology or psychiatry, logo therapy, animism, Taoism, and wildism. Jeriah loves to revel in the wild places with his fellow wild beings, some of his favorites being his partner Angie and their two furry children, Bruce and Gertrude. Although his home is in the desert, he currently resides in occupied Chepenethea Kalapuya land, more commonly known to settlers as Corvallis, Oregon. Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, Jeriah Bowser.
Oh, thanks.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. I kind of wanted to start with our correspondence, and it began really when you put out a request on a Facebook page for people to read an essay that you wrote, and you asked for some feedback, and I read your work, and I kind of felt a connection with my own thoughts and my own work, and you've since written a second essay, which this interview will kind of focus on, but I was wondering if you could maybe give us a brief overview of the first essay to our listeners.
Yeah. I believe the one you're referring to is Into the Wild, Part 1, towards an anti-civilized critique of civilization. And it's basically a summary of my philosophical journey, exploring anti-civilization principles. Short version is I am trying to put together a method of categorically critiquing and resisting all the philosophical assumptions of civilization. And I have it's it's an interesting project because a lot of the all the isms that you just read off in that list, they all add a lot and they all contribute a lot. But they also, I don't know, I've just discovered a lot that it's missing. And so I've kind of come up with this term, wildism, although there's other people also using the term. And for me, all wildism is a philosophical tool for critiquing civilization. So, for example, when I read an essay or a book or, I don't know, just learn about an ideology, I can look at this and use the tools of wildism and be like, all right, do I see objectification, dualism, private property, hierarchy, anthropocentrism, androcentrism, and more likely than not, you're going to find these kind of like the substructure, the philosophical underpinnings of these ideas, the assumptions that never go mentioned, they're just always present. And in my readings of philosophy and anti-civilization literature, it's just been really interesting to start to discover these, you know, like pretty much every ideology I've ever heard of contained all of these assumptions. It's curious what it would look like to get past all of them and what lies beyond that. And obviously, as I open the essay, using the tool of philosophy to try to critique all this philosophy is ultimately hubris. I mean, I realize that. But for as of right now, like I'm not in a position to go run off into the woods and never be seen again. So this is what I do to keep me occupied and busy, and gives my life meaning to use the tool of civilization, which is philosophy, to critique it.
Right, right. In your second essay, you kind of give some tools, and one of the things that really kind of caught my attention was the importance of kind of conveying yourself with your bodily sensations, which kind of helps connect, the body and the emotions. Most of us are always in our head, so to speak. And you talk a great deal about the importance of paying attention to your body, and I was wondering if you could kind of expand upon that for us.
Yeah, so that comes into the wild part two, which is where I go into more of the praxis of the theory that is part one. And this is basically my life's work up to this point as a guide has been basically figuring out, of course, I had no idea this is what I was doing for the vast majority of my career. Only now do I have the language to realize, like, oh, I'm doing rewilding. That's what I'm doing. This is all very intuitive work for many years, and now I can actually say that. But, so a lot of this has to do with teaching people or facilitating people in learning to trust their bodies. And I think this is really important because our bodies, oh man, this is hard to get into because I could talk for hours on this, and I have. our body is where all of our memories, it's where all of our trauma is stored. There's current trends in psychiatry which acknowledge and explore this, known as psychosomatic theory, and Bessel van der Kolk, and there's a lot of these guys that are realizing this and are realizing that our bodies are very, very fundamental for the healing process. Healing does not just happen in our minds. It's not
right.
The premise of psychiatry that we have to, this mind is this machine, this cognitive function that we just need to tweak and fix. It really fails in a lot of ways. So realizing that our body is, we can look at it as our primal self. And we disconnect from that as we are domesticated, as we grow up. We go to our family, church, schools. All these things serve to separate us. They kind of heighten this Cartesian void between our mind and our body until we're no longer manifest and we're no longer in our body. To be with our body would be to be an animal. No one would accept violence and domination and the processes of civilization if they were manifesting, if they were being with their body. You have to disconnect. You have to, be in your mind to be like, well, it's in my best interests, or, I have these morals, or I have whatever these things. I have this future thing I'm working towards. I'm just gonna let this domination. I'm gonna let this violence happen right now. So, what this looks like practically is, helping people be comfortable just being with themselves and being with their body. And a lot of therapy is built on talk therapy and, rationalizing and thinking about things and building new models. And I really try to strip that down and make it pretty simple. And
this is Guy. Thanks for coming on the show, Jedi. Let's go back to your first. And I'm going to ask a question that's rooted within your first two responses there. Almost all philosophers, certainly the vast majority before the 21st century, were white men. That is, they were writing from the perspective of the apex of patriarchy and all those isms you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And those white men weren't much into body work either. So this leaves you with seemingly endless material. Where do you start? Where do you stop? I mean, you could break this thing down for the rest of many lives. Yeah. Where does a person even begin to strip that all away? Does it begin with the animal self?
Man, I don't think there's an easy answer to that. it's obviously a process. But I'd say the simplest, if I could give you an answer, is just for a lot of people, is just being aware that this is a thing. Some people have never even considered that there anything else exists other than their mind and their ability to rationalize things. Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm wondering how this gets applied. You know, if somebody takes in the idea that we are human animals, and therefore our bodies matter, and our brains matter, and our senses matter, and our emotions matter, what's next? Where do I go besides the wilderness in my work to strip away those isms you mentioned so clearly?
I would say it looks like a direction. So I understand the entire world and processes of civilization and domestication as being, you could boil it down, if you had to boil it down to one word, it would be disconnection. Every single thing I ever talk about, it's all about disconnection. And my work is simply reconnection or building connections. And so we are disconnected, and I see this existing on primarily three planes, if you will. We're disconnected from ourselves, our bodies. We're disconnected from other humans, from human community. And we're disconnected from the biotic community, the world at large. And as a domesticated person, anyone growing up in this culture who's listening to the show right now, we have been thoroughly disconnected from all three of these planes. And where this is where the word alienation comes in. We're aliens in our own world. We have no context or culture or language to ground us, to situate us within our own bodies, our human communities, or our biotic communities. So no wonder we act in incredibly disconnected and destructive ways. And understood like this, these seemingly insane things like school shootings and the actions of corporate barons and runaway climate change, it makes a lot of sense. It's like, oh, of course people are acting like this. They have, they're totally disconnected. They have no context of community whatsoever. There's no responsibility. Why in the world would I go out of my way to protect something that, or to care about something that I have no connection to? So basically, to use the language of psychiatry, I'd say every single person in civilization fits the definition of a sociopath to some degree or another. Being sick, social being connection, ability to socialize, and empathy being sickness. We've lost the ability to connect. We've lost our connections. So to get back to your question, I'd say the process looks like heading on the path towards reconnection, towards these three planes. That looks like a million different things. And my work, I do a lot of facilitating that. And yeah, being in wilderness spaces helps a lot. It strips away a lot of the barriers to connection. But at the same time, it doesn't have to happen like that.
Yeah, you talk in your second essay a lot about the interplay between self and other, and I was wondering if you could kind of expand upon that for our listeners, because I think that's a great way that you kind of bring in reconnecting, so to speak.
Yeah, so the very base philosophical assumption here is that humans are self-conscious. We've developed self-consciousness. One way of viewing this is saying civilized humanity is the Earth's experiment in self-consciousness. We are the biotic form that the biotic community has chosen to experiment with self-consciousness, and this is what we're doing with it. So I'd say it's obviously a failed experiment. But that's one way to look at it, right? So right. Humans are self-conscious, which means that we have a distinct notion of self. And to have a distinct notion of self, you also have a distinct notion of other, that which is other. There must be some type of boundary or separation between the two. So this is called, objectification, which is used, somewhat commonly. People know that, you're objectifying women or you're objectifying these people. It's like, yeah, you're making them other. But the full implications of that, I think, are very rarely explored. Because we all objectify every other form of life, including ourselves, in a million different ways all the time. And, of course, this is a myth. I believe objectification is a myth, but albeit a very convincing one. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. How many people believe in religious myths and kill and die for them every day? So understanding that this is an illusion, that there is no essential distinction between the self and the other. I call this the self-other parabola simply because I don't know any other language to use for it. Our language doesn't really have good words for any of this stuff. But basically, it's the process of learning how I am on a physical and metaphysical level connected to every other living thing on this planet. So what happens to the Earth is what happens to me. What happens to, these people in other countries or in other communities or my family members is what happens to me. And how I treat others is also a manifestation of what's going on inside of me. So this theory presupposes connection as opposed to objectification, which presupposes disconnection. And obviously, a lot of people is, very, very hard to get their heads around as they walk around outside and go about their daily business through the world and realize that actually this isn't, extending empathy or extending self into others or practicing radical empathy with others is incredibly difficult and exhausting. I mean, go on any type of public transportation and there's no way you could sit there and like actively empathize with everyone on there. It'd be impossible and exhausting. So, this disconnection is if you look at it, is almost like a survival adaptation for mass society. And also the only way that civilization can function. Every single facet of civilization is predicated on violence and domination of other forms of life and the planet itself. So we have to disconnect. We have to believe that what happens to other does not affect us in order to act in these violent ways.
Yeah, I think Ted Kaczynski actually in his manifesto talks about hidden relationships, and that's really what civilization has done to us, is we don't see anything. It generally, stuff shows up, and we go and purchase it, or we take advantage of that particular service, but we don't see the path or the journey how it's reached us, and I think in some levels that affects clearly our empathy, because
absolutely.
We don't actually realize where it comes from. We just get it and then we dispose of it.
Not only that, if we were to think about it very hard, we wouldn't want to know because it's pretty painful.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah, you'd have to actually make a conscious effort to maybe make a decision whether you're going to act or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the flip side of this, which is pretty terrifying if you're willing to go here, is to realize the things that we do actually extend self into, because we all do. But usually those things are our vehicles, our smartphones, our social media avatars, our politicals, philosophical, religious ideals, sports teams. We all extend self. I believe this is like it's a fundamental part of, being human, being an animal, is identifying as extending self. And so, but instead of doing it with other actual living things, we do it with ideas or dead objects or technology mostly. I mean,
exactly.
I've used the example in my essay, but I'll use it again because it's so true. The other day I saw this guy, getting a little fender bender, his car got scratched, and this dude was livid. I mean, it was like he had been punched in the face. He was so offended that someone had scratched his car. It was such a clear manifestation to me of, like, of course, his car is an extension of himself. Like, he identifies with that. You see people with their phones or their social media presence, they get insulted or this need to, they're projecting themselves onto the, basically, technology. Their lawns or their houses. The list goes on.
Or their career.
Absolutely. But, of course, these things they're projecting onto are completely, they cannot reciprocate relationship. They're not living things. Your sports team or your political ideal will never reciprocate relationship. It will never have as have meaning for you as it, as you know, as if you did it with your, you know, extending self into a tree or an animal or another person. There's a reciprocation of relationship. So it's not that we're not doing it in civilization, it's that we're doing it to death. We're basically extending self into death, into the void, and nothing is being returned, which further alienates us.
Right. You've mentioned several times language, and I was wondering if you could talk about the limits of language as far as self is concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, English sucks.
it's clearly.
Experience, I mean, not that I'm a linguist at all, but I would say I've read books from linguists, and I very much see what they're talking about. English is the most disconnected form of language. It's only because I think it's the most colonized, the most, you know, has so much power in history and really just so much colonization behind it. That, and of course, our language reflects our reality. So how we talk about things, it's a symbolic medium. It's how I communicate. And there's, I could go on about this for a while, but... all of these philosophical assumptions that I talk about are also built into the language. So to like speak in a way that gets past these verb tenses and this problem of self and other and all this stuff, this parabola, it's very hard. And because like there simply is not words to convey these concepts because they're so repressed and so hidden for thousands of years. So to try to create something meaningful within this medium is pretty difficult. It's a thing I'll probably be working on for a while. But,
well,
yeah, I mean,
some of the words you used that drew my attention was radical empathy, and I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I just talked about earlier, as far as extending self into other. So
yeah.
I would say I differentiate between radical and shallow empathy along similar lines as the deep ecologists differentiate between deep and shallow ecology. So I would call shallow empathy, you know, like you see a video online of, I don't know, something sad happening, and we're like, oh, that sucks. You know, it's like it's a thought process. Like that must be really sad. You have compassion. Maybe you give a few dollars. And I would say radical empathy is primarily a body experience. It is actually feeling in your body another being's pain or suffering or joy or happiness or excitement or whatever. It's a process of actually allowing another's experiences to physically affect you. And again, I think we all do this to living things and to dead things. Whenever someone you love is experiencing intense emotions, we all feel that. This manifests in tons of different ways. You hear about, you know, twins that hear about the others in trouble, or siblings, or parents that know their kid is in trouble, or something good happened miles away, or I don't know. It's happened to me many times, or I've had friends that were having, you know, mostly for me, it's been really difficult experiences, or really sad, or experiencing suffering, and I just knew it, like, because I was so close and connected with them, my body knew it before my mind did. And of course, a lot of this has to do with my own rewilding process and learning to trust my body. But radical empathy is simply the act of allowing yourself to feel the connection that you have with another thing. It's a fun practice.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last, the Progressive Radio Network. We're with Jeriah Bowser, and he works in rewilding, and he does some wilderness and nature therapy, and I was wondering if we could kind of delve into that a little bit and some of the experiences that you've had with people that come into a particular program that you're facilitating and talk about what people are going through and what you see out there.
Definitely. I love talking about this. It's my life's work. Any specific questions or just general?
Well, in general, I mean, you talked a little bit about privilege, and I talk a great deal in my work about privilege, and I taught high school for a number of years and worked with a fair amount of privileged students, as well as myself being a highly privileged individual, and I was wondering kind of maybe some experiences you've had seeing people go through your program and maybe some of the changes.
Yeah. So, yeah, essentially wilderness therapy is, I mean, it's the radical concept that wilderness is healing, right? That the wildness is contains healing. You can heal through wildness at base. However, the industry itself has been, I would say, almost entirely co-opted by psychiatry at this point, and it's kind of lost any radical critique. It's kind of become, I don't know, bourgeois car camping clinical psychology in a lot of ways, which is really sad. And there's a lot of reason why I'm trying to move away from that and move towards my own practice. But yeah, so I mean, the basis assumptions of it is, if you take these young adults or sometimes old adults that are experiencing suffering and meaninglessness and disconnection, you take them out in the wilderness, away from technology, away from culture, and you place them in a small group with other humans who are also, going through the same process, and you just wake up every day, and you eat breakfast, and you hike, and it's really simple. It's reality. You just deal with reality. When you're an asshole to somebody, you have to wake up the next day and face that person. You have to, you actually have to take accountability for your actions. The wilderness and, as guides, our job is to continually reflect people's behaviors and experiences back to them over and over again, in a way of showing them. Basically, it's a way of, we call it natural consequences, or holding people accountable. So in society, I would say almost every single action we take, all the consequences are mitigated. We never experience real consequences, or positive or negative. It doesn't matter. For example, simple thing is air conditioning or whatever. We don't have to experience the consequences of the weather. We don't have to experience the consequences of the darker light we have. We have lighting. When you are rude to somebody, you can never see them again, or you can, there's no social consequences. All of those are mitigated through psychiatry and the penal system, or just anonymity. And so wilderness therapy is a way of taking all these layers of mediation away and saying, you are responsible for yourself. If you are too lazy to set up your tent right, then you're going to get wet tonight and you're going to be miserable. And that's not because anyone came in and punished you. That's because you were lazy. Or if you are really rude to people, they're not going to want to hang out with you, and you're going to have to live with the reality of, maybe it'll take a week or maybe it'll a month. But eventually you have to live with the reality, wait, people don't really like me because I'm a jerk. Interesting. I wonder if I should do something about that. So it's fair.
Immediate return.
Yeah, that's a great point. You live in a part of the world that is pretty renowned for the number of people who are outspoken about the system and who are living differently. I'm wondering if you can tell us who your primary influences are and were throughout your life. And before you do that, I want to mention that we are taking calls. This is Nature Bath Blast on the Progressive Radio Network. You can call us toll-free at 888-874-4888. Go ahead. Who are your primary influences in your life to this point?
I'd say, first and foremost, the desert. By the desert, I pretty much mean the area of the Colorado Basin, mostly the deserts of southern Utah. I consider every single, basically who I am today is due to the desert taking me under its wing and having compassion on me and teaching me its ways. After that, I would say the guides and students that I've worked with. I'd say about half my friends online, on social media, are former clients of mine. I've learned an incredible amount from, at this point, probably thousands of clients I've worked with, as well as my fellow guides. After that, I'd say pretty much, the general cohort of anti-civilization theorists. Obviously, I'm good friends with John Zerzan. I moved to Eugene with the large intention of, mentoring under him. Derek Jensen's Language Older Than Words was hugely impactful on me, in a lot of ways put me on this course. Jacques Ellul, identify strongly with Neo-Luddism and the critiques of technology. A lot of the eco-psychologists and the eco-psychology authors. I have almost 1,000 books in my bookshelf right now. there's a lot of people.
Sure. You met some of the people you actually, well, you mentioned a group, you mentioned ecofeminists, and I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about what you found useful in their work.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of ecofeminism. So, like, I understand civilization, right? There's many narratives for understanding this weird thing that we call civilization. One of them is disconnection, like I mentioned. Another one is just the narrative of yin and yang. I say yin and yang instead of femininity and masculinity because the concept of femininity that I'm referring to is much closer to the Taoist concepts of, as in they're way more metaphysical and spiritual than like Western essentialist definitions of gender or sex or sexuality that are connoted with femininity. But I would say the entire narrative of civilization can be understood through this narrative, coming from agriculture being an incredibly literal manifestation of masculine energy raping the earth. You take these iron plows and you rip the earth open and you forcibly sow your seed into it, and you watch it and you fertilize it and bring around, you prevent any abortive instinct, and then you violently rip the product, the children that the earth created, birthed, away, and you use it for your own purposes, and you do that every single year. I understand agriculture is a yearly festival to rape, which is a pretty intense thing to say, but wow. I mean, it also makes a lot of sense why rape and sexual assault is so prevalent in our culture.
Right.
And you know, the foundations of patriarchy, of war, the nuclear family, which I understand is the breakdown of communities, all these things can be traced down back to the suppression of femininity within civilization. So this looks like on each one of us, and personally, we all have potential yang and yin energy. It doesn't matter if your genitalia is externally or internally oriented. It has very little to do with, like I said, Western definitions of gender, sex, or sexuality. It has everything to do with we all have this potentiality for us, this potentiality within us that we can choose to manifest. And civilization, especially as a male, someone who's been assigned the gender of male within our culture, it is, I have had all femininity like thoroughly eradicated out of me through my upbringing, especially within fundamentalist Christianity. So any potential like nurturing or compassionate or empathetic or any like yin, you know, connoted yin characteristics have been destroyed, and I've been taught to perform as a masculine, aggressive, assertive, dominant male. And so understanding this how this process works in me, what this looks like for rewilding is basically re-feminizing, learning to understand and embrace my own femininity and understand the balance and the interplay of yang and yin in myself, and being okay and comfortable with my own femininity, which is, a pretty radical thing to do in a culture of total masculine dominance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's a journey that's a lifetime journey to get through and to break down the domestication, so to speak, and the indoctrination. People always ask me, you know, is something you can complete and are we ever fixed? And I don't think we are. I think it's a process that you just keep peeling back layers and layers and layers, and it's there.
In fact, I would say that the dominant culture has a word for what you described, the complete lack of femininity, the lack of empathy. The dominant culture calls this success.
Yeah, they call it success, right.
Absolutely.
We have a caller. Matt, you're on. Do you have a question?
Hi, Guy and Jiraiya. Just did a quick scan of some of the books that you've written in the Elements of Resistance, Violence, Nonviolence, and the State. Looks like a fantastic read. I'm really looking forward to delving into it deeper. The introduction on Amazon discussed a rather violent and unpleasant experience you had while incarcerated. My background is I taught the incarcerated meditation for 7 years, and I didn't see any of this day in and day out because I was in and out and doing my job, but I knew that it was happening and I was well-researched, etc. I was really struck by the relationship of your decision to be a rewilder and to kind of get back to, nature, etc., as being such a polar opposite of your experience in jail. I'd like to hear your comment on that in general. But this Nature Bats last show is really about a situation where we're all coming to the conclusion that there's just not a lot of hope, and there's just nothing much we can do about the situation where we're facing a choice of neither fighting nor running, but submitting to the results of Mother Nature. And this fight, flight, or submit situation appears to be, you know, the introduction to your book, Elements of Resistance, where you watched your friend being beaten, but you chose not to fight, not to run, but to submit to the system that you were in.
So first off, yeah, I'd say all of my work, both in the field and my philosophy and whatnot, is very much driven by my personal experiences. I make no claims to objectivity, or everything is deeply subjective and personal. And yeah, I mean, I'd say my upbringing was pretty fucking terrible and traumatic in a lot of respects. And I spent a year and a half in a very violent facility that I'd basically left deep impacts of trauma on me as a person. And I'd say that literally being introduced to the desert and becoming a student of the desert was really my savior. And I didn't know this at the time, of course. I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is great. This is a great job. But looking back now, over almost a decade of doing this work, I consider myself unbelievably fortunate. And I don't view any of my ideas or my work as the product of my intelligence or because I'm so radical. I view it as I'm just mentoring under the desert, and I'm on a process of healing. And all my work as a wilderness therapy guide is very personal, and I approach it on a very personal level, because I say at base, I'm a logotherapist, which anyone who's read Viktor Frankl's work will know what that means. And basically, doing this work and doing my writing and all the things that I do, basically it gives my life meaning. It's providing meaning to my suffering. So instead of all the things that I experience being just this huge question mark, which will just fucking destroy you, just like not knowing why, I choose to make meaning out of it by resisting and by pursuing healing and relationship. So that ties into your second comment or question, which is, yeah, there is so much hopelessness. And I would call that, and I know this isn't philosophically correct, but to the layman, I would call it nihilism. It's this overwhelming feeling of disempowerment. And I address that a little bit in my book, but I actually, I could have done a much better job. But I view rewilding resistance as therapy, as providing meaning for my life, as I'm basically fighting for my soul back. I'm like fighting to take back what has been taken from me. So I have no qualms of stopping or resisting. Like, I have no fantasies. I am fully aware that within, you know, a couple decades, there will be violent collapse, and most people, including myself, will probably die violently. I totally get that. I have no fantasies of stopping civilization or, you know, starting this movement. That's not the point at all. The point is, this work has meaning for me right now. When I resist, whether it's anti-fascist action in the streets, or I don't know, there's a million ways to resist. Whatever I'm doing, I'm monkey wrenching, or doing my work, or I don't know, whatever it is. Whenever I'm resisting, I am fighting for, I'm undomesticating myself. I'm refusing to accept the narrative of civilization, which says that I am, you know, that I just need to sit here and take it and be like, this sucks. So it's like, maybe I can't stop all the trees, but I can't save them all, but I can save this one. And that's meaningful for me. And maybe I can't, heal or directly impact every domesticated child out there, but I can impact a few thousand of them, and I have, and I'll continue doing that. So I'd say the answer to that is would be to find what you love. I know people say that on here all the time, but I think it's so true. Find what it is that you love, like connect, what is it that you connect to, and fight to protect it. Not because you think you'll stop anything or, you don't know, but just because it has meaning. I mean, I found that to be true for my life, and I think it's true for a lot of others as well.
That's great. Thank you for mentioning Viktor Frankl's work, which I think is excellent. And even the ultimate atheist, Fritz Nietzsche, indicated that nihilism is in such a bad route. In a couple of minutes, can you tell us what's next for your work? Where are you headed? Do you have another 7 or 8 books coming out, or are you going to be appearing on television every day? What's going on?
I always have tons of writing I'm working on. I'm taking a break from guiding right now because I love the work, but it's very emotionally exhausting. It's very intense work to do for this long. So I'm taking a break from guiding right now. Ideally I'm trying to find a way to move back to the desert. I live in the Pacific Northwest right now, but trying to find a way to move back to the desert and buy some land, liberate some land, and start establishing a long-term relationship with the bioregion that I love, and invite others to come do that. And I'm hoping to start my own kind of wilderness therapy type practice. And I have no idea if I'll, if this will take the classical route, if I'll need to, get a degree and do that. I mean, as of now, I'm totally self-educated, or if it'll just look like inviting people there. But that's kind of my long-term plan, is to get to the desert, get some land, and to keep doing what I do, because it's very hard to do the work that I want within the industry of wilderness therapy, because it is so co-opted by psychiatry at this point. It's just very hard to do it anymore.
Yeah. Well, right on, man. I mean, hey, come on out to southwestern New Mexico. We can hang out and you can check out the Gila Wilderness.
I will do that.
Thanks very much for being on the show with us. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we look forward to more of your writing. Keep writing and keep sending them in our way, because I enjoy it, it opens my eyes. So I feel a connection to your work. So thank you very much for being on the show, and good luck, and keep in touch, man.
You as well.
All right. Peace. That's Jeriah Bowser. He is a rewilding expert out of Oregon. He's been our guest today. Guy McPherson was recently on National Geographic Explore with on a show with Bill Nye, the science guy, and we're going to discuss a little bit of that and how we thought it went down. So, Guy, your initial thoughts from seeing yourself on the tube?
Well, when I saw the 30-second commercial come out, I was very disappointed, and I thought, great, another hatchet job. Because in just 30 seconds, it goes through. We talk to deniers, and it has a little quote from a denier. We talk to believers, and it has a little quote. And we talk to alarmists, and it has a little quote from me. Jeez, I'm not an alarmist. The information is alarming. Yeah. I'm sounding the alarm. It doesn't really make me an alarmist, I don't think. Anyway, so I was my expectations were low, and they were greatly exceeded. I thought they did a very professional job. Of presenting my viewpoint without making me look like an idiot. And I have no problem looking like an idiot. I can do it by myself. You don't really need me to do any editing to make that happen. So I was actually quite pleased.
I watched it actually. I watched your portion of it last night. Somebody down in the area here DVR'd it, and then I watched the entire episode on YouTube right before we went on the air. And it's seemed to me a couple things. One, once they got to bargaining, the rest of the show was bargaining. I mean, they got to the end, and acceptance was no longer acceptance, it was bargaining.
Absolutely. I thought they went through the 5 stages, and then they spent the last 5 or 10 minutes on bargaining again. We're re-bargaining now.
I mean, I don't know. I didn't understand. They didn't really have an acceptance part, There was more of, well, let's just go back to technology, and we'll work our way out of this. And so it just seemed to me that the last half hour of the show was complete bargaining. They went to cars.
Right. They went to cars and other means of maintaining the heat engine that is civilization.
And that's the thing I think they missed. They never actually question the bedrock of keeping this all going. Okay, so we have a different fuel source, or we're powering it with something else. But if we keep just devouring things, I don't understand that people can't see that.
Well, right. They never mentioned that the civilization is a heat engine.
Right. Well, they never
even though you know, they interviewed me for 6 hours. You don't think I mentioned that about 85 times?
Right. Yeah. I mean, civilization doesn't even come up because it's just a given that this is the way people live. People
right.
meaning us.
Right. And they can't see beyond that. Like almost everybody else can't see beyond that. So
yeah.
It also seems to me, though, that
I think it's okay that people would refer to you and many of us as alarmists, because there aren't any alarmists in this culture. There are none that I can point out besides the people I know in this small world of Nature Bats Last and you know, the world of doom, quote unquote, so to speak. So I actually think that's a word we could embrace, because there are no alarmists. There's nobody that's panicking. There's nobody pointing things out and going, hey, this is kind of alarming.
Right, right. This is disturbing and alarming. Maybe we should try doing something different, as our guest just pointed out.
Yeah, well, so I think I'm going to actually start referring to myself as an alarmist, because nobody else is.
Right. That's probably a good idea. It'll give you a niche all your own.
It'll give me a niche on my own. But, you know, I think it just seems to me that we keep discussing these things, and we have shows like Bill Nye's show, and it's like watching the movie The Titanic. You know the ending, and you just wait for the technology hope to come in at the end, and it does every single time. And then it's usually preceded with, well, if we get busy right now, we can fix all this, and here's how. And then he gives you, you know, the two scenarios, the doom and gloom, and then, of course, the hope, and then him and Arnold feel good about things, and they can go on, you know, living their lives on television.
Right. Yes, it's all about maintaining this set of living arrangements at every cost and never looking under the covers to see what kind of hidden relationships are buried there.
Right.
I mean, this is a perfect conversation to have after the one we just had with our guests.
Yeah.
Because every single show, and I really appreciate that Castle Pictures took this on and that they got Bill Nye right away on board, and that they really did cover a lot of very important stuff.
Yeah, they did. I felt the first 30 to 40 minutes covered a fair amount of really good information, and then, you know, pretty much after you were on, it started to get where it normally goes with these
right.
types of conversations and programs.
Right, exactly. Mark Jacobson at Stanford University.
Oh.
You know, the wealthy white guy make a lot of money telling people that we just need to go renewable. Well, if we go all renewable, if we manage to pull that off, all that does is eliminate global dimming and lead to temperature rise that causes our demise that much faster.
Right.
Good move.
I mean, it was that part of the show is just dripping in whiteness. I mean, he's doing a TED talk, and he's, you know, and of course he
right.
doesn't, you know, he couldn't answer the question of, well, how are we going to get everybody together to pull this off worldwide?
Right. And Nye, I thought, did a great job, very subtly pitching at the end, well, do you think the oil masters of the universe are going to stand for that?
Right.
And the guy says, well, cut.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're pointing it out without being obvious about it. He was intimating that we're not going to do that.
Right. No, clearly we're not. I mean, that's the thing I don't get. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. And, you know, these people are scientists. That we are
yeah.
somehow going to make this sort of leap or this change. It's not happening at all right now, but they still have this hope that without any evidence at all that it's going to happen.
Right. And they never, ever mentioned that these so-called renewables are actually derivatives of fossil fuels. It takes a lot of energy from coal and a lot of oil and a lot of rare earths to make solar panels and wind turbines and all that other stuff they were talking about. Where's that
right.
going to come from? Unicorn land? I mean, come on. You can't just say something and have it be believed. You know, the New York Times had Andrew Revkin do
yeah.
an analysis the day before. I don't know if you read that. And he got a hold of a copy a day or two early, obviously, and he wrote about it. And the only evidence he could present that took issue with anything I said was a 2-year-old blog post.
Well, he must have really done.
That's the evidence stacked up against the several hundred journal articles I present,
yeah,
pointing out that we're in the midst of abrupt climate change, is a blog post written years ago.
You know what they call that? They call that cherry picking.
Oh, I'm familiar with that concept, having done a little bit of it myself.
Cherry picking alarmist.
Yeah, yes. Guilty as charged.
Yeah, so you know, a couple people had asked me who had watched the show, is there going to be more of Guy on? Because, you know, I heard they filmed for hours and hours and hours. I go, no, you don't know how television works. They film for hours and hours and hours so they can get their 2 to 3 minutes tops and pick what they want. That's why they do it that way.
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about the overview of how the thing came to be, how I came to be involved, and where we ended up where we did.
Okay.
So Chris Cassell, the producer of the thing, called me on the phone. He probably sent me an email message first, but the first time I talked to him on the phone, he said, we're going to do a 6-part series. Apparently at that point, they were in the midst of pitching this thing to National Geographic, and it wasn't a done deal yet. They were just in the process of putting together a proposal to National Geographic. So he said, it's going to be a 6-part series, and we're going to focus on the 5 stages of grief, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of grief. And we didn't know what to do with the 6 parts because we have 6 pieces. And I said, oh, not to worry. I've got this. Go with stage 6, Gallows Humor. And it was really quiet. Like he thought, did I miss something there? There was a 6th stage that came later and I didn't know about it. And I told him I was just joking, but that Gallows Humor is where I spend most of my time at this point. And then by the time they came out, it was down to a single episode. So apparently they didn't get the support they wanted from National Geographic for a six-part series. So it was just a 1-hour show. It was, you know, it was actually 44 minutes by the time you take the commercials out. And for that 44 minutes, they went to Miami and Miami Beach, to Sacramento to visit with Schwarzenegger.
Right.
To Stanford, that was probably all one trip, and to the tar sands in Alberta, and also to the Mud Hut, which is not exactly on the way to anywhere.
Right.
And they spent 6 hours in the Mud Hut. They went to the Mud Hut last, by the way, so that was some pretty clever editing when they'd asked Mark Jacobson about my work. That was before they actually came and quoted me. They knew what quotes they were going to extract out of me, apparently. even before I said them, it was scripted. And then they actually got me to say those things so that it fit with the script, which is fine.
Right.
So it was quite a long process. There must have been hundreds of hours of video they had that they edited down, which is a pretty impressive amount of work, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really a shame because I think they could have really made it into something. I mean, you've mentioned for what it was done fairly well. It met expectations, I guess, or it didn't hit the rock bottom for our expectations. But it seems to me that they could have really made this, you know, a solid 1-week series. But again, you know, look at who owns, you know, National Geographic. So
right, and here's something interesting: the deal was announced that National Geographic had been purchased by Rupert Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
That deal was announced to the film crew by me. They showed up, and we're sitting around the other kitchen table straggling in because they had 8 mm-hmm. people come from 4 or 5 different locations. And so we're sitting around in the other kitchen chatting about what we're going to do. And I said, so do you suppose this is even going to air, given who your new boss is? And they all look at me. What new boss? They had no idea.
Yeah. And now some of them may not have a job, you know, what, you know, Kevin Hester posted about layoffs.
Right, exactly.
Well, to McPherson effect.
As I understand it, the way this worked was Castle Pictures got the contract for this. Okay. So they just got a bunch of money after they pitched the proposal to National Geographic.
Yeah.
So I think none of these people were or are employed by National Geographic. There were two people from Castle Pix, the producer and the assistant, Isabel. And then the rest of the people they just hired, a few of them locally. There was a makeup artist who was from Las Cruces, and the drone guy was actually raised in Lawrenceburg, believe it or not.
And pretty cool shot.
Yeah, and went to college at New Mexico State University. So they had the drone guy. Yeah, I don't know how much he got paid, but counting his travel and his time, it must have been quite a bit of money for what was maybe a two or three-second shot.
Yeah, I mean, you almost have to pause it to get a good look at the landscape of it, yeah.
So that's the kind of money they're throwing at this sort of project, right, and the kind of materials they're throwing at it. Interestingly and ironically, Bill Nye, a couple of things. Right after he arrived, he told me that he didn't really accept my notion of near-term human extinction. It was going to be a lot longer than that before humans went extinct. And then within 3 hours, he was saying things like, I think you're being too conservative with your 2030 projection. and then another story he mentioned right up front was that he had a bet going with, Ed Begley Jr.
Oh, yeah.
About whose carbon footprint was going to be lower this year. Come on, Bill, you just flew over all over the world for 44-minute show.
Right. True. It would be interesting to see if your website, if the show and some of your book sales actually see an increase once this thing rolls a couple times. That 2030 date, because it was in the ad as well, I'm sure many people, that caught their attention, and then obviously the show itself. So it'd be interesting to see if there's any sort of quote-unquote bump from this.
Yeah, I thought there would be pretty soon, but I haven't seen any email messages to that effect. Admittedly, I've been camping, and I'm not even home yet. I've stopped alongside the road to do the show, so I haven't been really paying attention. However, I did notice that as the show was going, I stayed at a cheap motel in Moab, Utah, and as the show was running, I was getting numerous Facebook friend requests, way more than I typically get in a day, like an order of magnitude.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So some people were clearly paying attention at some level.
Yeah.
And I suspect it'll go somewhere. It's hard to imagine it couldn't. Well, by the way, if people want to see it, our friend Robin Westenra at Seymour Rocks already has it posted, embedded at YouTube, and there is a YouTube version of it available that you can find if you put in the search box at YouTube, National Geographic Explorer, Bill Nye's Global Meltdown. If you type that in there, it'll take you right to it.
I got it on our pages, too, so we're covered. So.
Oh, excellent. Good.
Well, we got about a minute left here, so I'm going to wrap up. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on Progressive Radio Network, or join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM, and feel free to post questions you'd like us to answer on the show. Sorry we didn't get to more calls. And check out Guy's work on GuyMcPherson.com, and we'll see you next Tuesday afternoon on the radio, 3 p.m. Eastern. And we'll be taking your calls, and if you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again for your calls this week to Afrizin for his music, to Jariah for his knowledge and his time. And remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.